Hello and welcome to another podcast from the Naval Historical Society of Australia. This is one of the many talks in the archives of the Society recorded over nearly two decades from 1973 until 1980, and now available for you through the Society's website. Today we're listening to the Saga of the Amethyst. Lieutenant Commander Cossadine served in the destroyer HMS Consort in 1949, at the time of the Yangtze incident.
Well, may I say good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I was asked to come and talk to you about the Amethyst incident, which took place in 1949. In fact, this evening I won't really be talking about the Amethyst all the time, because you may well see on the list of personalities I have my name included, purely as an ego thing, but in fact I was the navigating officer of HMS Consort, so consequently most of my story will perhaps be revolving around the activities of HMS Consort, and I will be bringing in at certain stages what happened to the Amethyst as well. So it all started on a quiet April day 30 years ago, and that of course is one of the reasons why I have a few notes, because it's getting quite a long time ago, when HMS Amethyst was proceeding on a peaceful mission up the Yangtze River when she was set upon by a Chinese communist gun battery and brought pretty near to destruction before she could fire a gun in her defense. Since that day, many significant changes have taken place on the political front in China, not the least being the visits of Mr. Nixon, who at that time was the United States President, Mr. Whitlam, and other diplomatic exchanges. And also, of course, the recent deaths of Chiang Kai-shek and Chairman Mao Tse-tung. In 1949, the people and the country of China had been torn by war for about 38 years, since Dr. Sun Yat-sen had overthrown the Manchu dynasty in 1911. And as the sun rose on those April mornings in 1949, the Red Armies of northern China now stood upon the northern bank of the Yangtze River, ready to cross. In fact, by 1947, the new communist armies were already on the march in the north, and in open revolt against the government of Chiang Kai-shek. They had struck hard and often, and everywhere the nationalists crumpled before them. Manchuria fell, Peking fell, also Tientsin, and rich with the booty of captured arms, their forces under the propagandist title of the China People's Liberation Army pressed relentlessly on to the south. They fought a great fluctuating battle of encirclement at Suzhou and drove the nationalist army in flight far south to the great natural obstacle, the Yangtze River. And there, in the spring of 1949, the two armies sat and glared at each other across the water along a front of several hundred miles. And so, amid the tension that preceded what was to be the final battle for China, our story begins to unfold. One of the responsibilities of the Far East Fleet was to provide the recognized guardship at Nanking, which at that time was the seat of the Chinese government, some 200 miles up the Yangtze River from Shanghai. And as you can see on the map, Shanghai, Nanking. quite a respectable sort of obstacle of a river. In Nanking was the British Embassy, with Sir Ralph Stevenson as the ambassador and Mr. Lamb as the minister. The naval attaché and the senior service attaché was Captain Donaldson, and the assistant naval attaché was Lieutenant Commander John Cairns, of whom no doubt we'll hear more later. In addition to the UK Embassy were also the diplomatic representatives of the Commonwealth, and of course an appreciable community of British business people and other interests. Now, all these people, as we well knew from the experience of 1927, when Nanking had been sacked, were likely to be in considerable jeopardy, and possibly scarcity also, if the situation got out of hand during the initial stage of the forthcoming advance of the Liberation People's Army. It was, of course, for this particular reason that we maintained the guardship at Nanking. And we did so by virtue of the old treaty rights, which had been honoured by successive Chinese governments and honoured even by the Japanese during their occupation before Pearl Harbor. Now, the first serious threat to Nanking had been early in November 1948, and this prompted Sir Ralph Stevenson to ask the Commander-in-Chief, who at that time was Admiral Sir Dennis Boyd, if he could furnish a guardship to bring essential supplies, to provide a stabilizing influence if the conditions deteriorated, and also for the guardship to be prepared to evacuate British and Commonwealth personnel. To this request, Admiral Boyd had in fact agreed, and the first ship that had been sent was, it so worked out, the HMS Amethyst. And of course, the sanction of the Chinese Nationalist Government had to be obtained first, and Boyd had also been anxious to maintain some sort of contact with the communist forces, but they themselves made it impossible for this contact to take place. Now, HMS Consort at this time was attached to the 8th Destroyer Flotilla based at Hong Kong and had been detailed off as the guardship for Nanking in early January 1949. On arrival, we made contact, of course, with the various embassies. We established a radio contact between them and the ship. We also made arrangements for the evacuation of the personnel and carried out various exercises by which we informed them through the radio contact that evacuation was to take place. They met at a certain spot in Nanking. They were then transferred to the lowest part of the wall that surrounded the city, and which in fact had a little creek running alongside it. Consort provided the motor cutter and the whalers, and we carried out this exercise of transferring the personnel from shore to ship. The ship was at the wharf, just at the outside of Nanking itself. The consort sat in Nanking for about 3 months, and by this time the provisions and stores were beginning to get fairly low, so it was agreed that we would be relieved, and it was understood, of course, that if in the event that the communist armies crossed the Yangtze River so rapidly that there was no possibility of getting the personnel away, it was, of course, agreed that we would, that the guardship would have to stay in Nanking for some considerable time. So it was essential that we had a ship there that was fully stored and provisioned and ready to sit and look after these people for a considerable period. Hence, the detailing of HMS Amethyst to come to relieve us. The Amethyst departed Hong Kong and went off to Shanghai. And on the 18th of April, she received orders to sail for Nanking the next day. This would enable her to reach Nanking and the consort, steaming at speed, to reach Tianjin, which was outside the main crossing area, on the 20th of April. And consequently, the relief would be completed before the communists gave effect to their threat of renewing hostilities. That was the halfway point from Shanghai here overnight, and then the next day up to Nanking, and consequently the consort would have repeated the same track. The Amethyst duly departed Holt's Wharf in Shanghai at 8 o'clock on the 19th of April, stopping only to disembark her British pilots off the Wusan port and to take on two Chinese pilots. The Yangtze, with its shifting sandbanks and its numerous islands and its seasonal floodwaters, is at all times difficult to navigate, especially from October to April when the water is in fact low in the river. And the reason for these two particular dates was because the two armies had in fact imposed a truce. The communist forces had put forward to the nationalist government a peace program, and there was to be a truce whilst the nationalist government decided whether or not to accept it. So consequently, the relief and turnover had to be completed between the 3 or 4 days that the truce was in operation. However, shortly after leaving Shanghai, the Amethyst learnt by signal that the nationalists would not accept the communist surrender terms, and that consequently the People's Liberation Army would cross the Yangtze on the morning of the 21st of April, which however would still give the Amethyst time to have arrived at Nanking, to have effected the turnover with consort, and for consort to steam down the river and anchor overnight prior to her final steam down to Shanghai. Uneventfully, the Amethyst steamed up the river until at 1700 on the evening of the 19th, she reached Tianjin and stayed there overnight as navigation of the Yangtze River at night was prohibited, as well as being pretty hazardous. On the morning of the 20th, about 5 o'clock, the Amethyst weighed and proceeded up the river in the light of the early morning. And although veils of mist clung about the surface of the water, it was expected that she would reach Nanking during the early afternoon, and of course in anticipation of her arrival, consort was busy preparing for sea. At 8 o'clock that morning, as she neared the troubled area, and I'll just again mention that the troubled area was between Tianjin and Nanking, the captain, who was Lieutenant Commander Skinner, gave orders for certain precautions to be taken. The vessel carried huge painted Union Jacks, and these were furled, hung over the side, ready to be dropped in the event of trouble. speed was increased to about 16 knots, and all hands were piped to action stations, and the ship was placed in the first degree of readiness. And she went steadily on her way. At about 8:30 that morning, with a little island called Low Island being to starboard, there was a crackle of rifle fire. A few moments later there was a louder shock and a fountain of water shot up near the ship. Other shells followed, over and short of the ship, but fairly close. The next precaution was taken, and that was to break out battle ensigns, and the Union Jacks were then unfurled so that they draped over the side to indicate to the gun batteries that were firing that in fact the ship was British. The captain ordered the gunnery control officer to open fire as soon as the targets could be spotted, but the mist was a handicap to vision, and the faint puffs of smoke observed made it difficult to fix on a definite target, so in fact Amethyst did not open fire on that occasion. By about 8:45, after about a dozen rounds had been fired by the communist gun battery, the fire ceased and the orders, hands relax action station, was given, and at that precise time the Amethyst had escaped being hit. Some 40 minutes later, the Amethyst was steaming at reduced speed with the flat Cowan Reach on the starboard hand and Rose Island flat and marshy to port, and that little island there, as you can see, it is Rose Island, and that's the Cowan Reach. So the Amethyst had in fact left her overnight anchorage, had steamed along here, right the way up through here, and was just in that vicinity where she was then fired upon again. That was about 9:30 on the 20th of April, and at that time everything was nice and peaceful, when all of a sudden a shell whipped over the frigate from the starboard side and plunged into the sea. The captain at once ordered full speed ahead and turned the ship to the south bank to A, increase the range, and to decrease the target area. Now you can appreciate that there's not very much increasing the range to be done in a very small river such as that, but however, that's what happened. And then events moved with devastating speed. And what happened in the next few minutes was so devastating that it's really difficult to relate events in their ordered sequence. Four shells in quick succession hit three separate and vital parts of the ship in as many seconds, and interacting consequences of each brought Amethyst to the brink of destruction almost in the twinkling of an eye. A shell crashed directly into the wheelhouse, completely wrecking it and seriously wounding three of the four sailors closed up at the wheel and engine room telegraph. The fourth sailor, although knocked down by the blast, recovered and took the wheel and endeavoured to call up the voice pipe to the bridge. On the bridge, the captain, seeing the ship going too far to port, gave the order, hard a starboard. But her bows were already pointing south towards the shoal of Rose Island, with her engines going full speed, and obviously didn't have very far to go. Having kept to the northern part of the bank of the river, she was then heading down towards Rose Island there. Now, the personnel on the bridge at that time was the captain, who was Lieutenant Commander Skinner, Lieutenant Berger, who was the navigator, Lieutenant Meyerhouse, the action officer of the watch, Ordinary Seaman Driscoll, Signalman Roberts, one of the Chinese pilots, and Lieutenant Weston, who was the first lieutenant and the gunnery officer. The captain instructed the first lieutenant to open fire. Lieutenant Weston gave the order, "Open fire," to the director, and at that precise moment, two direct hits were made on the bridge in rapid succession. And it was completely disastrous. Every soul on the bridge was either killed or wounded. Lieutenant Commander Skinner fell grievously hurt and lingered in pain for nearly 2 days before he died. Ordinary Seaman Driscoll fell dead immediately. The Chinese pilot was mortally hurt. In fact, I think the back of his head was blown off. Speaks for itself. Berger and Meyerhouse were both wounded and unconscious. A shell splinter took out Roberts' eye, and Lieutenant Weston was struck by a shell splinter which tore through his lower lungs and lodged in his liver. And meanwhile, of course, Amethyst was still steaming at full speed towards the shore of Rose Island. Weston, of course, was still on his feet, and he tried to con the ship back into the midstream by giving the order, "Hard a starboard." Of course, as you remember, the wheelhouse was shot away. So when this failed to have any effect, he decided to use the engines and gave the order, "Full astern, both engines." Now, in the wheelhouse, the one sailor that had escaped injury stepped from where the wheel had previously been and went to the port telegraph, pulled the lever from full ahead to full astern. He then attempted to do the same thing with the starboard telegraph, but the lever just wouldn't move. He was unable to pass the order by voice pipe because it had been severed when the shell struck the wheelhouse. And so, by all these extraordinary combination of mishaps, with her port engines stopped, ready to be put astern, and her starboard engine still going at full speed ahead, the Amethyst drove her bow very firmly into a mud bank 150 yards from the western shore of Rose Island, and stuck there very firmly, and of course was a sitting target for the communist guns. Lieutenant Weston thereupon immediately made a flash signal to all ships, which read, "Under heavy fire, am aground in approximate position 31 degrees 10 minutes north, 119 degrees 50 minutes east. Large number of casualties." Now, on receipt of this signal in the consort, of course, the captain was advised. Now, as I said previously, I was the navigator of HMS Consort, and because of certain shortages in those days, an officer was not only a navigator, he was also the communicator and the mess secretary and the captain staff officer and a divisional officer and all sorts of things. So consequently, when the signal was received in the wireless office of HMS Consort, the telegraphist came galloping up at full speed and, of course, looked for the communications officer, who was myself, and with a pretty shaky hand, handed me this signal, which I read, promptly folded up and put in my... You must remember we were in white tropical rig, and I folded the signal up and I popped it in my pocket, and it is here this very minute. Of course, the captain was advised. So this, in fact, is the very signal that came into the wireless office and was handed to me on that fateful day in Nanking, and I've retained it, and this one has a piece of the original one, that's it. course, if my Lord's Commissioners of the Admiralty realised that I've got an official document in my pocket, I could probably be hung, drawn and quartered for some official secret sat no doubt, I'm not quite sure. Knowing that we were going to be relieved, of course, by Amethyst during that forenoon, the captain, Commander Robertson, had gone off to the British Embassy to say his farewells. So we had to advise him of the receipt of this signal, and of course he then immediately advised the ambassador and Captain Donaldson, the naval attaché. Commander Robertson, of course, expected and soon received orders from Admiral Madden to go at once to the assistance of the Amethyst. And whilst he was advising the ambassador, we, of course, already having been started our preparations for sea, pushed the boiler going and got everything else organised. So immediately he came on board, all we had to do, we were all singled up and were ready to slip immediately the captain came on board. So we set off from Nanking. He took consort down the river at 29 knots, which was obviously faster than any other ship had ever travelled on the Yangtze River, and left a lasting impression in my mind of exactly how you could gauge the speed of a ship. She made enormous stern waves which spread across the river and began to come forward and further forward until in fact they were reaching right past the bow of the ship and were breaking onto the river bank and completely overflowing onto the shore on either side. And in fact there were little bamboo buildings of some description, whatever they were, but were just being completely and utterly sort of knocked over by the force of the wave, and the stern was sitting down and almost looking like one of the fast motorboats that one sees on Sydney Harbour. And I can assure you it was really a great feeling to be on board at that precise moment. However, of course, we weren't there for pleasure, so we were already closed up to action stations, of course. We also had our Union Jacks all ready to drop over the side, but realising, of course, that wasn't going to do us very much good. We steamed down from Nanking down the river, and our objective was Rose Island and HMS Amethyst. When we got to the town to reach, we were fired upon by a couple of gun batteries, and the captain very nonchalantly gave the orders to open fire to the gunnery officer, who by this time of course was, you know, had a very itchy trigger finger, and we fired off a few salvos of 4.5s, and we knocked out three enemy guns at that stage and received no hits on board the consort. We thought that was rather good actually. However, events later showed that we weren't really as good as we thought. I'll just put on that slide. You'll see also that this map, of course, is on your little handout sheet. Of course, the Amethyst track, and where she went ashore, this also shows the track of consort as she came down the river, along here, round, San Chiang Ying with a fort, which as you can see was right opposite Amethyst, or this one, and one there. The Sin Ning Mu Ho Creek had all those invasion craft secured alongside. As we came down, and got just about here, we sent a signal to Amethyst to ask her if her main engines were usable and whether it was possible to tow her off the sandbank. And the Amethyst replied to us that it wouldn't be possible until the gun batteries had been silenced. Well, we decided that's what we would do. We would go ahead and silence the gun batteries, and in the meantime we asked the Amethyst to stand by and be prepared to be towed from the stern. And whilst all this chit-chat's going on the signal lanterns, the consort had, of course, passed the stern of Amethyst. We had continued to go down the river, we made our turn here, and we returned to come, our plan was to come back and get down here somewhere and then send the tow lines over and start to tow her off. We had been fired upon occasionally and had returned the fire, and then all of a sudden, one might say, all hell broke loose. We ran into very serious and unexpected trouble. As you can see, at the head of the creek there were the forts and gun batteries, and in the invasion craft were numerous troops and guns. And it was probably for this reason that the battery at San Ching Ying was such an aggressive one. They had assembled all their invasion craft and was one of the main assembly points ready for the crossing. So as we came back up the river, they had very quickly brought out all their anti-tank guns, most of them of 37mm caliber. They had concealed them in hedges and undergrowth along the bank, and they opened very rapid fire upon us at a range of only about 400 yards. How about that? That's the distance. And in fact, more and more guns were brought out, and they were handled with great boldness and determination. You have to switch off that. Yeah, thanks. Now, Consort then suffered the same ill fortune as the Amethyst. On the bridge was the captain, myself. We had another officer on the wing of the bridge who was firing a machine gun. And the captain giving me the helm instructions, and of course standing on the binnacle, leaning very trembly on the binnacle itself, and I was on the platform passing the orders down to the wheelhouse. Shot and shell were flying backwards and forwards. We were returning the fire at great rapidity, when all of a sudden there was a great crash and no reply from the wheelhouse. Smoke came out of the voice pipe. I reported this fact to the captain, and he said, nip down and have a quick peek, see what the score is. So I went to the companionway that led out from the after part of the bridge. Was halfway down the ladder when I heard two more explosions, and I could see that two shells had in fact penetrated the rear of the bridge. I didn't stop to investigate that one because I was going to have a look at the wheelhouse. And to my dismay, I found that it was a shambles. Everyone in the wheelhouse was killed. The coxswain was dead, his quartermaster and his engine room telegraph chap also killed, and the whole place a complete and utter shambles. So I didn't stop there very long, as you can well imagine. I went back on the bridge, and again, to my dismay, I found the results of the damage that had been caused by the two shells that came in through the back of the bridge. And I considered myself very fortunate, because these two anti-tank shells had in fact sliced off both sides of the binnacle platform upon which I had been standing only a couple of minutes beforehand. The captain was lying in the corner of the bridge, wounded. He hadn't actually been hit by a shell, of course, but the splinters from the wooden platform had sprayed out, and of course, if you can imagine the situation of the bridge, he's standing in the front of it there, and the binnacle and platform here, of course you can imagine how the woodwork sprayed around, and it hit him and sprayed him right from the legs up into the back. So he was then lying wounded on the deck. I had to give instructions for the ship to change over to steering from the tiller flat. Then it was a question of utilising telephones to pass helm orders to the tiller flat and also down to the engine room. So you can then imagine me standing there with a couple of telephones trying to talk to various people. In the meantime, the ship had received further direct hits. One of them had hit the radio room and had killed all the guys in the radio room. Another one had hit the mess deck and had put out the main gyro. There were other hits here and there, and lots of information coming through from damage control. On one occasion, the damage control phone rang, and I grabbed hold of that and was trying to juggle the others, and the report came through that the forward magazine was on fire. So after getting my breath back, I passed this information through to the captain, who said, right-ho, flood the magazine, and I passed that order back and sort of sat or stood trying to cross my fingers and say a prayer or two. When again the telephone rang again, and the guy said, look, I'm terribly sorry, but it's not a fire in the forward magazine, it's a fire in the forward mess deck, which wasn't quite so bad, although in fact it was quite bad enough. However, obviously the whole of this damage then precluded any possibility of towing the Amethyst away from Rose Island. And very reluctantly, the captain decided that to save the consort, we just had to go off and leave the Amethyst to her fate. Well, of course, you can imagine the disappointment that would have been felt in the Amethyst when they sighted consort disappearing at full speed down the river. You can probably realise the not quite so much disappointment, but certain amount of joyousness, no doubt, in the consort to have escaped with only 15 killed and about 35 wounded. One of the shells that had hit consort hit the wardroom. And as you know, the wardroom is generally used as the hospital in times of action. And consequently, when the shell struck the wardroom, people who had already been wounded were wounded for a second time. And also the surgical instruments were also destroyed. So the doctor and his assistant had quite a bit of a problem in looking after people. We learned afterwards that approximately 250 communist soldiers had been killed by the gunfire being returned by the consort. And also, when you consider that A gun and B gun had been put out of action, also, it wasn't such a bad score, we didn't think. A gun had an anti-tank shell right through the barrel, which put that one out of action, right through, without, almost through the centre. And B gun was put out of action, a shell went through the turret and went through the working systems and I think killed the Leia or trainer, I'm not quite sure which one, but she was no longer able to train. Consort continued to steam down the river to anchor overnight at the anchorage and also to meet there the London and the Black Swan that had been sent off from Shanghai to give further assistance to the Amethyst. Of course, we went alongside London, transferred all our wounded to her sick bay, and received the rather startling news that the next morning, the London and Black Swan, with consort in company, were going to go back up the river to try our hand again. And we weren't very happy about that, I can assure you. And we sort of pretty badly dismal, I can tell you. But however, fortunately, good sense prevailed and it was quite obvious that there was nothing that we could do. So we were told to press on down to Shanghai and that the London and Black Swan would go up there showing the flag and race along and pick up the Amethyst and bring her back. However, that didn't eventuate because after the London and Black Swan left the anchorage, within a very short space of time, they were also fired upon, and in fact London had about much the same casualties as Consort, about 15 killed and 30 or 40 wounded, and it was Admiral Madden's turn then to make the bold decision. And he then decided that there was nothing he could do about it, bearing in mind the circumstances of shallow water, not very wide river, huge bulk of the ship, the London, and he decided that it was time for him to turn round, and consequently sent the signal to Amethyst to say that they were returning to Shanghai. And of course, during all this lot that's been going on, of course, what's happened to the Amethyst? Well, quite a lot had been happening, of course. Initially, they tried to get some of the wounded ashore, which they did, in fact, eventually do. It was a case some at part of the time jumping from the frying pan into the fire, because as soon as they started to take the people ashore, of course the gun batteries from the northern bank fired upon them, and it was a question of, you know, whether they should stay on board the ship which was being fired upon spasmodically, or in fact get ashore and go off and find some refuge ashore. So some did, some went ashore, some stayed on board. Then it was a question of whether the ship should remain where she was. Western, in fact, did finally get her off the beach and got her back into the river. And he moved her backwards and forwards until he got a final anchorage, which he considered was quite safe. And then, of course, all this lot was generating world news. A frightful thing had happened in China. A British ship had been fired upon, and so on and so on. So consequently, there was all sorts of help being suggested. As you can see, the first help, of course, was the consort racing off from Nanking, which failed dismally. The next bit of help was the London and the Black Swan, which came up from the anchorage to help, and that failed dismally. they were too far away to send aircraft. There was nothing really, any fighter aircraft within reach. Diplomatic pressures, of course, could have been brought to bear, but, you know, what diplomatic chit-chat is, it goes on for ages and ages and nothing really happens. So the only other thing that they could do was to send in medical people, and a Sunderland was detailed off to fly from Kai Tak Aerodrome in Hong Kong to fly out and to land on the water near Rose Island and to pass over doctor and medical supplies and so on. And that in fact did take place after two or three hazardous attempts. And also one of the more ludicrous sort of moments, I suppose, in all this seriousness business, you've got to have a bit of humour, and the gunner, a guy called Monaghan, if I remember right, who in fact came out to Australia, like a lot of us POMs have done, and spent, I think, a period of learned service with the Australian Navy at one stage. He was in a sampan going backwards and forwards from the ship to the shore where all these wounded people had been landed. When he saw the Sunderland coming in and went off to assist the doctors and what have you to take them off to the ship. And he hopped in the aeroplane and was passing out all the medical supplies and so on, when all of a sudden there was a whacking great salvo of shells dropped near the Sunderland, and the pilot revved up the engines and took off and took the gunner with him, much to his chagrin, because he reckoned he'd been done out of a pretty good hero's welcome when he got home. But he didn't really desert in the face of the enemy, but it really hurt him, I think, to a great degree. I don't think he ever got over it. But however, that was one of the silly things that happened. Then, of course, the other help, and the most important bit that really made the whole story, of course, was the fact that Lieutenant Commander Kerins had been detailed off by Captain Stevenson to go and find the Amethyst, to take command of her and sort out the situation. Kerins eventually did find the Amethyst after, you know, lots of problems. I understand that he got fairly close to her one night when Weston decided to move from one anchorage to another. So it took him quite some while, I think, until the following day before he could track her down some few miles further along the river. And finally, he did board her. He reviewed the situation and decided that Weston should go ashore. You know, he was pretty sick and had been under considerable stress and strain for quite a long time. And he received official confirmation of his command. And then he began to study the situation with a view to getting either Amethyst out or the crew ashore and back to Shanghai. He moved her from one anchorage to another, and on the final anchorage, whatever that date was, I think it's on the second slide. That's where she went on the beach first. She was moved down to this anchorage, and then she moved to this one, and then right along here to this one, but as you can see there were gun batteries there. Then they moved up to number four, another gun battery there, and I think finally it was Kerins that took her to anchorage number five. And there she sat for 101 days. During that 101 days, Kerins had considerable discussions with the general who was in charge of this area, with a view to A, finding out who was responsible for the whole fracas, whether or not the Communist People's Liberation Army would allow her to go down the river, and so on and so on. There was considerable trouble, of course, as to who they could pin the blame on. The Communists said that it was the Amethyst that had fired the first shot. Well, we obviously know that that's not true. They then began to make excuses and say, well, you know, we thought it was a nationalist ship that had promised to stay in the anchorage, and after the crossing had been completed was to haul down the nationalist flag and pulled up the PLA's flag. And because we thought that she was breaking her word, or this is what we reckon, because they thought she was breaking her word, that they fired upon her. However, all this chit-chat went on purely as a stalling device, because quite obviously the PLA wanted the ship. So it was a question as to whether or not Cairns were going to get the ship out or get the crew out. Cairns, I understand, always had the thought in mind that he would get the ship out. So consequently, there was all this chit-chat. And of course, during all this time, stores were running low. And if it hadn't been for the fact that the crew was about 97 short, this was of course killed, wounded, and those who were ashore, no doubt the food would have run out long before the 101 days. But the main problem, of course, was the fuel supplies. And whilst I've got some figures here, I can't remember them all, the fuel was the big problem. On the 20th of April, when she ran aground, she had 365 tons of fuel oil and 14 tons of diesel oil. With the hope of an early release, the ship had been using 6.5 tons of oil a day. A month later, the amount was down to 170 tons of fuel oil plus 9 tons of diesel. And it had been worked out that 30 tons should be set aside for a passage down the river. So consequently, there's only sufficient oil for a further 26 days, after which the ship just wouldn't be able to move anyway. So consequently, Cairns began a long and exacting course of fuel economy. And by the 3rd of June, however, the stocks were down to 136 tons. And by the 9th of July, down to 62.5 tons. Fortunately, Cairns had negotiated for supply of oil, and on the 9th of July, a lighter appeared with 54 tons of oil, which was transferred to the Amethyst, which made a total of 116 tons. As I said, Cairns had quite seriously considered getting down the river, but he had to send signals to the Commander-in-Chief to ensure that it was okay politically for him to take this course of action. And they went into a series of gobbledygook, or whatever the terminology is, and Cairns considered that if a typhoon came and there was big heavy rainstorms, he would probably be able to slip the anchor and go down the river under cover of a rainstorm. So he sent a signal to CNC which said, "Grateful for your advice, please, on my actions if menaced by a typhoon. Have informed the General on several occasions of this possible danger in order to hasten matters." And a couple of days later, the Commander-in-Chief replied, again in gobbledygook, because I couldn't understand it either for quite a while, so I'm quite sure Cairns couldn't. It said, "Typhoons are unlikely to reach you in serious strength, and you are in good holding ground," which would have made me think that they had to stay there. However, it went on, it said, "The golden rule of making an offing and taking plenty of sea room applies particularly." So obviously there was a limit that he could go off and get plenty of sea room. Then it said, "We all listened to your special broadcast last Sunday." And the final sentence said, "I hope another one will not be necessary." So obviously there were two clues there for Cairns to pick out. But unfortunately, he didn't pick them out for about a fortnight. And then finally, when he did, of course, he was full of self-reproach, because he then realised that he was getting the okay to make a break. So on the 30th of July, the fuel was down to about 55 tons. And subtracting 16 tons for the estimated loss by suction, which only an engineer would know what it was all about, I don't, it left 39 tons.
Dragged to the bottom of the tank.
Yes, so that left 39 tons. After they'd flashed up the boilers, there'd only be some 33 tons left, of which 30 tons was required to get them down from the anchorage out to sea. So it was a pretty dicey business. And that was the 101st day of the vessel's captivity. So during the afternoon, Cairns reviewed the situation, made his final decision, and sent the following signal to the Commander-in-Chief. I am going to try and break out at 2200 tonight, 30th of July. Then he got all hands on the quarterdeck and told them the situation. They were all ready to slip the anchor at 2200 that night. Cairns was on the bridge. Everything was all ready. And all of a sudden, a merchant ship came round the corner of Ta Sha Island, which was one of those just there where they were anchored. And it was a vessel which had a very appropriate name, actually, I thought. It was called the Kiang Siang Liberation. The last bit, I thought, was the significant bit, of course. And to Cairns, it was a heaven-sent opportunity, because as soon as she went past, with all her lights blazing, he very quietly let the anchor go and followed along behind her. And in less than 30 seconds, the Amethyst was moving downstream, going slowly ahead on both engines, her bid for freedom having begun. For some half an hour or so, she pursued her silent course. There was no life anywhere except for the lights of the Liberation. And half an hour later, flares shot up into the sky. The Liberation replied with a siren signal and altered course to starboard. And the Amethyst, following closely up behind, did the same thing, very close astern, just following every movement. Then a second flare lit the sky and illuminated the Amethyst. She took no notice of this and just continued quietly along astern of the Liberation. And all of a sudden, the landing craft that appeared let off a burst of machine gun fire. Then the shore batteries woke up and fired a few shots. And Cairns thought, well, this is about time we made a real break for it. And he put on full speed ahead and started to slowly pass the Kiang Yang Liberation and finally got ahead of her. They looked astern and were quite amazed to find that the gun batteries were still firing at each other and concentrating their fire on the Kiang Yang Liberation, which finally caught fire and ran aground. This, of course, was good for Cairns because he just continued to steam down the river unmolested at that point. At 1 o'clock in the morning of the 31st of July, the Amethyst then came close to the next danger point. And this was the old nationalist naval station of Kiang Yin that had a boom crossing. She approached this boom area, making smoke, and she was again challenged by flares, and when her identity was disclosed, came under fire again. And then a moment of dangerous uncertainty faced the Amethyst, because if the boom was closed, she would be in trouble. Even the fact that there were boys there didn't give any indication to Commander Cairns as to whether the boom was open or not, so he just had to make a great decision right at that very minute, and fortunately he decided to leave a boy to the starboard side. There was no boom, and she just went whistling through with shell and shot firing over, and whatever boom there was there Amethyst didn't see it. At 0245 in the morning, having completed 100 miles of his sea passage, he signalled the Commander-in-Chief, 100 up, and the Admiral replied, magnificent century. Or terribly British, and that sort of thing. The last hurdle then drew near, and these were the forts of Pao Shan and Wusang, which Cairns regarded with deep misgiving, obviously because if one direct hit on the Amethyst with their 6-inch guns would probably have blown her to bits. And she was obliged to pass the Pao Shan fort at a range of less than 2.5 miles at about 5:30 that morning. At 5 o'clock, every man on deck could see the searchlights ahead sweeping slowly to and fro across the area through which the ship would pass. And I'm getting this bit from the book, actually. The cold white fingers searching ghost-like across the dark water seemed escapable. Cairns ordered the engine room to give him everything you've got. The Amethyst raced on as she had never raced before. Everyone on board was taut and silent. Gradually, the ship passed through the swept area, her tired coxswain still standing squarely up to the wheel, until at last the harsh glare of the searchlights was astern of her, her smoke barrier now a safe blockage to the rays. 10 minutes later, the first gleam of day showed in the sky ahead of them, and at 5:20, the distant outline of HMS Concorde could be seen on the horizon. Cairns passed the news to the engine room, and in a moment it had flashed through the ship. Concorde had seen her too and signalled, "Fancy meeting you." To which Cairns replied, "Never, never has a ship been more welcome." Amethyst was out in the open sea again, the wide and limitless sea, and she was free. The two ships sailed in company to the Saddle Islands. As they approached the islands, the engine room reported, "Sir, we are just about to lose suction." Cairn said, "Never mind, chum, we are just about to anchor." So, amid rejoicing, the scoured and rusty frigate and the trim destroyer lay alongside each other. All hands relaxed, and Cairn sent his final signal to the Commander-in-Chief, which you probably all know, "Have rejoined the fleet south of Wusang. No damage or casualties. God save the King." To which the Admiral replied, "Welcome back to the fleet. We are all extremely proud of your most gallant and skilful escape and of the endurance and fortitude displayed by everyone who has been rewarded by such success. Your bearing in adversity and your daring passage tonight will be an epic in the history of the Navy." And I guess it was.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you're looking for more information about Australian naval history, then you should use our website. You'll find more podcasts, articles from our quarterly in-house magazine, Naval Historical Review, and a range of e-books, monographs, and ships' plans for sale in our online shop. If you have any questions or research inquiries about Australian naval history, then feel free to contact us. Use the link on the website homepage. The Society is a not-for-profit organisation which relies on your continuing support. Please use our website links to become a member, or donate now, or sign up as a volunteer, or subscribe to our newsletters. See you next time.